Welcome to the Madden America podcast, your source for science, psychiatry, and social justice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Madden America. This is Ayurdhi Dhar, your host for today's Spotlight interview. At MIA, we just reported on a study published in BMJ, which found that 2 out of 3 people do not find antidepressants worthwhile, given their current adverse effects. The authors found that the burdens outweighed the benefits for 2 out of 3 people. Our guest for today is Dr. Swapnil Gupta, whose work explores similar themes. Dr. Gupta is an associate professor and medical director of ambulatory psychiatry at Mount Sinai. She did her medical training in India and residency in the US at Yale and SUNY. Dr. Gupta has written extensively about deprescribing from and discontinuation of psychiatric drugs. We will talk about what that means, how it is achieved, and the complications that patients, their families, and psychiatrists often face if they choose to stop or reduce psychiatric medication. We will get into the importance of patient choice, recovery, the debate around relapse, which is far more complex than I ever imagined it, and more. Dr. Gupta, welcome to Madden America.
Thank you, Ayurdhi.
So let's jump in. Let's start with a very basic thing. What is deprescribing in psychiatry?
Deprescribing was originally defined in geriatric medicine and palliative care medicine. As you might imagine, the older that people get, more and more diagnoses get added to their, to their medical records, and with more diagnoses come more medications. Geriatric medicine introduced deprescribing as a way of removing medications whose benefits really did not outweigh the risks, either at the current time or at the future time. And either reducing the dose of these medications or slowly reducing them down to a stop. And all this is done keeping in consideration the patient's medical status, their values, do they want to take the meds or not? Are there other ways that they can handle the same condition? And what is how they're functioning in their environment?
Thank you for that. I mean, I remember when I was a student, I covered an article for Madden America about geriatric medicine. The statistic was terrifying. It said that inappropriate medication use and polypharmacy was one of the leading causes of death for geriatric patients. So, with that, why did you see, or when did you see, that there was a need for deprescribing in psychiatry?
I think one point which I would add to my introduction is that I also worked as a psychiatrist in India. And so I did a residency training there for 3 years in Chandigarh and then worked as a psychiatrist in India for a couple of years. So I moved to the United States in 2009. And when I moved here and saw the medication list, I was quite surprised, to say the least, that the med lists were so long, and from the perspective of standard guidelines, like the American Psychiatric Association guidelines, the med combinations just didn't make any sense. In fact, some combinations just seemed overtly harmful. So, you know, whether I called it deprescribing or not, I was cleaning up medication regimes right from the beginning. And I think as I completed my training, got to the attending level, I realized that we needed a name for this intervention, just so we could talk about it, we could get people to discuss it, get people to get really mad about it, oppose it, and, you know, in general, just have conversations about it. So my colleagues, John Cahill and Rebecca Miller at Yale, three of us sat down and discussed, I think three of us agreed on the point that this intervention needed to be, systematized. And we wondered about what we'd like to call it. And we went over medication tapering, medication streamlining, and decided on deprescribing because there was already some precedent in geriatric medicine and palliative care medicine. And honestly, I wish that in a few years' time, we don't need it anymore because everyone is prescribing really carefully to begin with.
So tell me then, how do you gauge a patient comes to you and, you know, or you've been working with a patient for a very long time? At what point or how do you gauge that a patient now needs to be tapered off their medication? Or maybe the medication is still benefiting them or the risk is too high? What does that look like?
So, you know, honestly, that's a really complicated question because so many factors go into it. If I have started the medication, at the time of starting it, I do ask the patient, how long do you envision being on it? So, you know, this conversation of reducing the medication or stopping it has begun at the time of starting the medication. And of course, that depends on, you know, what condition is being treated as well. So if I'm treating a depression and I'm offering the person an antidepressant, I do very clearly ask them, like, how long do you think you might be on it? If it's somebody that, you know, it's like an, you know, what's called an inherited patient who's been in the system for a long time and they've got passed on to me and they're on high doses of antipsychotics. I think the first thing to do is just review the records. There might be instances where this person's doctor tried to taper their medicines and it just didn't work out, or they tried to taper the medicines in a very sort of uncoordinated and abrupt fashion, like they just went ahead and halved the dose of the antipsychotic, which, as we all know now, is completely inappropriate and a recipe for disaster. So we take note of that. If a careful taper in the past led to a very, very distressing outcome for the patient, like they got hospitalized and they're absolutely not interested in touching their medications or changing them, then we just leave it at that. If the life circumstances of the patient have changed, they're feeling more comfortable, they have a good, you know, living space, they're in a good relationship, I, as the doctor, have other people I can talk to about the patient and, you know, who can support them in this process of withdrawal. So, you know, it's just an unending list of factors that come in. But the most important thing is how does the patient respond to the suggestion? And are they interested? What kind of reactions they're having to it?
So then that brings me to the next obvious question, which is how common is it for a patient to come forward and initiate a conversation about, I would like to stop taking my meds, as opposed to you or let's say a physician in general, approaching the difficult topic of deprescribing and discontinuation?
So in my opinion, very few patients will actually say, I want to stop my medicines. Because the reputation is that once you're on a psych med, you have to be on it forever. And if you taper off your medicine, your psychiatrist is going to get really mad and not see you anymore or call the police or have you put into the hospital or something of that nature. So very understandably, what I think most patients do is that they tell their psychiatrist that, yeah, I'm taking the medicine. But they're actually not. And I completely understand why someone would do that. If I were taking prescribed medications constantly and there was the risk of me being hospitalized if I didn't take them, I would lie too. So perfectly understandable. So I think that for the patient to comfortably, you know, to feel comfortable bringing up that question of tapering meds or wanting to stop them, the relationship has to be good. Both parties have to be really transparent. And I think the doctor has to really demonstrate that they care about the patient more than the fact that the patient is taking the medication.
So tell me about, like, the need for deprescribing, right? What have you noticed when it comes to, like, polypharmacy, which is so many prescriptions? What are some of the effects or the adverse effects that you have noticed for patients who are taking multiple drugs?
That's a really important question, I think. You know, polypharmacy is like the clearest situation where deprescribing is absolutely needed. For want of a better phrase, that's a no-brainer. For instance, if you give somebody a benzodiazepine like Xanax or Klonopin, along with a medication that is supposed to treat nightmares like Prazosin. Now, Prazosin is a drug that lowers your blood pressure. And as we all know, Xanax and Klonopin can cause people to get dizzy. It can cause incoordination. Now, imagine a person who's 60 years old at 8, 9 p.m. They live alone at 8 or 9 p.m. They finish dinner. They take their Prazosin or their Xanax and Klonopin. And they're sitting and watching TV. They get up from their couch to go to bed and fall, right? Because their blood pressure has gone down, they're sleepy, their coordination is messed up. So that's like a classic example of polypharmacy. And if you're even older and, you know, if you've been taking your antipsychotic medicine for a long time, that reduces your bone density. So chance of having a fracture goes up. So you're going to have a hip fracture. And then you land up in rehab for 6-8 weeks or something like that after the surgery. So that's a classic situation that I'm really worried about. But then there are other situations which, you know, which have like caused really practical problems for me. Now, there is an antifungal drug called fluconazole that's given for, you know, people who have fungal infections on their nails or, and then, you know, everyone knows clozapine, which is a antipsychotic medicine that comes with a huge number of side effects. Now, both fluconazole and clozapine will cause problems in the heart rhythm. People should not be taking that medication together. So you have to be really, really careful about that, right? And fluconazole is typically prescribed by the primary care doctor. Clozapine is managed by psychiatrists. So just being very mindful of those drug interactions is important. I've had a case where my patient was given fluconazole. I panicked, ordered an EKG for the patient. The heart rhythm abnormalities were pretty significant. We had to stop the clozapine, restart the clozapine after a week after the fluconazole had gone from the blood. So, yeah, so polypharmacy is a huge issue. But, you know, that being said, there are some very small things, what I like to call low-hanging fruit. You know, like when people are given doses of risperidone and given Cogentin or benztropine to manage the side effects of the risperidone. There's a good chance that if you drop the dose of risperidone by 1 or 2 milligrams, they're not going to need the Cogentin. And Cogentin causes a lot of side effects on its own. So there are very, very small things that if psychiatrists pay attention to, we can just, you know, reduce the side effect burden, reduce the chances of adverse events because of drug interactions, and improve quality of life.
All right. So let's kind of get into the process of deprescribing now, right? What are usually the common reactions that you see from patients and from their families when you have this kind of a conversation or when another prescriber might have this kind of a conversation that, hey, should we think about stopping, you know, this or reducing this prescription drug?
You know, I almost never open the conversation with, should we think about stopping? You know, it's a more open question, something like, tell me about these medications, how they're working out for you. Are they causing any problems? I think the relationship is very important. I need to make sure that the patient has a certain amount of trust in me, that I'm not going to, you know, unilaterally change their medication or just impose my will. So I think to make that very clear, there are two things that I offer. One is that I'm not going to change medications without consulting with you or without getting your input on it. And the second thing is that I'm just trying to understand how you feel about these meds. There's one more thing is I'd really try to emphasize is I'm not worried about whether you're taking the medications or not. I'm worried about whether you're feeling okay or not. You know, there are patients who say that I'm feeling well. I don't even want to talk about this. Just refill my prescriptions and I'm out of here. Which is completely understandable because often these are people who have been, you know, either brutalized by the police or have had horrible experiences on inpatient psychiatric units. They don't want to land up back there. You know, they are afraid of getting angry with family members or mistreating their family. They may have spouses who say that if you don't take your meds, I'm leaving you. I had this one patient who would get very angry with her mother. And the last time she had stopped her medicine, she had punched her mother and broken her nose. So she was, you know, she was just terrified that I don't want to stop my medicine and any change would just make her so anxious. There are some people who see the conversation as the beginning of a more transparent relationship. For instance, I build up all the strategy inside and I say, okay, what do you think about the pink pill that you take every night? And, you know, and the patient says to me, oh, the pink one, I haven't taken that for 6 months. So, you know, it's a chance for both of us to be transparent. I think deprescribing opens the door to building a better relationship with the patient.
In the process of, you know, working with a patient and you're trying to reduce a medication, let's say, there are multiple factors that you talk about and we can't go through all of them. But I want you to tell us a little bit about how important are things like the right timing and psychosocial support when you are trying to get a patient off, you know, psychiatric drugs or reduce them?
Yeah, I think just considering the timing is extremely important. So I work at a site that has a lot of trainees. And, you know, so the patient's doctors change every year. Not all the patients, but a substantial number of patients. And this change happens in June and July. So obviously, that's not a good time to change medications. One is because the transfer of information from the previous doctor to the next doctor might not be complete. The patient is in the process of establishing a relationship with the new doctor. So, that's one situation that comes to mind very, very immediately for me. Like that's an important factor in my immediate environment. But there's so many things for the patient. Like if we know that they're going to have some instability in their living situation, if we know that, you know, there are some relationship troubles are brewing, if they've recently lost a beloved pet or a beloved family member and they're already quite depressed about it or sad about it. Those kind of things, losing a person who's really important to them, like a therapist. These are just some examples of bad timing. These are all things I would take into consideration. That being said, I don't think there's ever a perfect time to do it. So sometimes, you know, if a combination is dangerous or even slightly like contraindicated, then you have to go ahead and talk to the patient about it. So it's a balance between the urgency of the need for deprescribing and what's going on in the patient's life. Yeah, so psychosocial interventions are, you know, if we look at it from the evidence-based perspective, there are pretty clear-cut evidence for, let's say, mindfulness-based CBT in the prevention of recurrence of depressive episodes. So that part is easy to implement. Connect the person with a good therapist who's able to offer CBT for depression if you're going to taper off the antidepressant. So I think peer support is extremely important. Connecting the person to other resources where, you know, people are talking about withdrawal symptoms, people are talking about strategies for safe tapering is really important. Clinically, what I found is one of the most important things while tapering drugs is to reassure the patient that the withdrawal symptoms that they're experiencing don't mean that they're crazy. You know, for example, some of the experiences like brain zaps, it's hard to put that experience into words. And I have patients, you know, moving their hands in the air, trying to explain to me what's happening in their bodies, but they're not quite able to. So if they connect with someone who has had the same experience and they can talk to each other and say, oh, yeah, I had that too. And, you know, the two people know what the other is talking about. I think that's a really big relief that I'm not the only person in the world to whom this is happening. And it's the medication doing this to me. There's nothing else that's terribly wrong with me here. And just because we know so little about the process, and you know, there's a large consumer community doing this, like a large tapering community. I really think it's important to learn from them and connect with the community and figure out what kind of strategies actually work. We also try a number of lifestyle changes, like small things like CBT for insomnia. If we are tapering off, unfortunately, Seroquel is prescribed just for sleep on many occasions. And you know, I think that's a pretty egregious thing to do. So while tapering off the Seroquel, we put the patients or offer the patients CBT for insomnia groups. And again, that is evidence-based. There are clinical trials, head-to-head trials of CBTI against Seroquel for insomnia. So again, a very simple, harmless intervention that can replace a fairly problematic drug. In some cases, family therapy might be indicated, teaching the family how to handle, small emotional ups and downs, teaching the patient how to interact differently with family members.
You mentioned withdrawal, so I'm going to get into the difficult one, which is withdrawal versus relapse, right? This is a tricky one, and to understand which one is it. And I know we used to think that discontinuation of antipsychotics just instantly will cause relapse. But recently, there is more and more evidence that's looking into the effects of withdrawing from the same drug and evidence around dopamine supersensitivity. I know this is a difficult question, but oh my God, how do we know what is it? And can we ever know what is it? Is a patient relapsing into some kind of an original condition that they had? Or is this withdrawal caused by reducing, the drug? And because people usually think about withdrawal and they think about, you know, cocaine and things like that, right? How do you deal with that? Like knowing, not knowing, informing patients and family about what it is?
You know, it's obviously going to be different for antidepressants and antipsychotics. I think for antidepressants, the withdrawal syndrome, at least in my experience, it's a little more clear cut because there are a lot of physical symptoms that pop up, like brain zaps, feeling tired, feeling fatigued. In addition to some very prominent emotional symptoms like crying spells or just feeling very irritable or getting angry, even suicidal thoughts or wanting to kill yourself. So all these things come up. But I think if the physical component is really prominent, it's pretty clear that this is because of the antidepressant withdrawal. And, the surest way to establish that is that as time passes, the withdrawal symptoms will hopefully slowly dwindle and disappear at some point. There is, of course, a small percentage of individuals who will have protracted withdrawal syndromes. And I think it's important to remember that the patient group is not a monolith. There are people who are going to taper off antidepressants without any problems. There are people who will have protracted symptoms. There are people who will have symptoms for 4 to 6 weeks and then they'll slowly die down. As far as antipsychotics go, again, it's really hard to tell. I think when people abruptly stop medicines like clozapine, the symptoms appear so quickly that I you know, just by the timing of the symptom, I think it's more likely to be a withdrawal syndrome that appears first. And it's possible that as time goes past, the withdrawal syndrome subsides and some sort of an underlying syndrome, the primary illness emerges. That's a possibility. There is a chance that as the withdrawal syndrome subsides, nothing will emerge from under that. But there's but by that time, I think the person has already been reinstated on the antipsychotic because the withdrawal syndrome itself is just so disruptive. There are some physical symptoms of antipsychotic withdrawal as well. Like there can be a series of movement disorders. The commonest one that I've seen is like generalized fasciculations all over the body that can last 4 to 6 weeks, but slowly go away. The one that's most commonly written about is a worsening of the tardive dyskinesia. There can also be a dystonia that acutely appears as you're tapering the medicine. There can be some symptoms like stiffness and tremors that can get acutely worse. Many antipsychotics are very, very powerful antiemetics or drugs that prevent vomiting. So patients can feel nauseated, patients can have diarrhea or symptoms of what's called a cholinergic overload because antipsychotics also have an effect which is called anticholinergic side effects. So symptoms of cholinergic overload are classically like diarrhea or sweating too much or having a runny nose, things like that. You know, there are small studies and case reports that are done in gastrointestinal disorder clinics where patients are given antiemetics or drugs to prevent vomiting for long periods of time. And when these drugs are abruptly withdrawn, patients can have transient psychotic symptoms. And these are patients who have never had psychotic symptoms before.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit about dopamine supersensitivity? Like there is just more and more stuff coming about it, but it's still a little unclear.
As I understand it, that like a long-term blockade of the dopamine receptors, which is what the antipsychotics do, causes the dopamine receptors to increase in number. So there's not enough dopamine coming through, so the number of receptors increases. And then you suddenly remove the dopamine blockade. So, you know, so that area of the brain becomes hypersensitive to dopamine and it's super sensitive to dopamine. And that's the mechanism for like a withdrawal psychosis or withdrawal tardive dyskinesia as well.
So I have two big things to ask you now. One is that you've written about deprescribing being in line with recovery-oriented approach, right? The whole recovery movement in mental health. And the recovery movement emphasizes things like patient choice and patient preference. And you write about some very important things like the right to fail and the dignity of risk and how for some patients, functional recovery might be more important, which is, you know, can I keep my job and maybe have a good social relationship? So I just want you to tell me a little bit about recovery-oriented approach and how deprescribing is in line with that.
You know, there are four main pillars of the recovery-oriented approach, like person-centered care, honoring patient autonomy, and fostering hope and empowerment. Right. And as a part of the person-centered care, there's shared decision-making as well. And I think deprescribing is not even possible without actually adhering to these. As, you know, as we saw in our conversation for the past half an hour, that the approach is highly individualized. So in that sense, it's very person-centered. It's what works for the patient. And it's impossible to have a cookie-cutter approach to deprescribing. It's not possible to carry it out without actually having the patients okay. And I'm respectful and very mindful of the fact that it's the patient taking the medication. So obviously, they know best how it's affecting their life. And patients are already very mindful of the fact that I'm the person who knows about medication side effects, how it might affect the rest of their body, and things like that. So I think in a space of mutual respect and mutual understanding, we reach a common goal and move ahead with that. So again, it's very aligned with shared decision making as well. And I do think it's very empowering because in some ways it's telling the patient that, you know, medication is not the be all and end all of your well-being. And you have a right to say that, you know, I don't want these medicines. Can we work together and taper them off? There's hope for a medication-free life. There's hope for a life that's unencumbered by medication side effects. When we go to the, you know, to the right to fail and the dignity of rest, that gets a little more unnerving for physicians. Because we are trained to be cautious. We are trained to minimize risk. And to think that I would do something that would increase the chances that this patient could land up in the hospital or that this patient could start hearing voices again, for some physicians is just unthinkable, right? Because it's my job to prevent that from happening. But I think it's also important to expand the physician training and have them remember it's also your job to give the patient a good quality of life and to offer treatments that are in line with their values and their preferences. So if it's an informed decision that, okay, we are going to taper the Haldol by X milligrams, but, you know, there's a risk that the voices might increase, do we want to take that risk? That conversation needs to be had.
So has that happened? You know, patients saying that I'm actually okay with hearing voices as long as I can do these X, Y, Z things. And those are my priority over, you know, just some of the voices. Yeah. Has that happened? Can you tell us more about that? Yes, because we have just have such a pathologizing approach towards hearing voices.
Yeah, one typical example that comes up often is, you know, young people who are trying to go to college and who hear voices, but the voices are really well controlled with clozapine or another antipsychotic. But the problem is that the medication makes them so sleepy during the day that they just cannot stay awake during class. So then it becomes like a fine-tuning and, you know, a balance between, okay, if the voices just increase slightly, but I feel awake during the day and I'm able to sit in class. I have had one patient who wanted to taper the meds slightly to see if they could stay awake during class, and it worked out fine. So we consolidated the dose, moved it to the evening, dropped the dose of clozapine slightly. And that really helped this person stay awake, at least, you know, between the times of 10 to 2 p.m. I've also had patients who said, I don't care if I land up in the hospital once a year. I'm not taking this medicine. Which I think is not an unreasonable choice. Like if they have to take something like haloperidol or flufenazine, you know, which can suck the joy out of your life. And if you land up in the hospital, you know which hospital you're going to, you know the staff at the hospital, you know that in 2 weeks you'll feel better and come out. That's not a terrible choice.
So this is my last question, and it's kind of one of the most important ones. I know you recently did a webinar around undiagnosing and deprescribing. Could you tell us about what do you mean when you say deprescribing and undiagnosing are two sides of the same coin?
You know, the first time I heard about undiagnosing was when we wrote, when John Cahill and I wrote our first paper in 2016. So luckily that paper was reviewed by, I'm not sure who, obviously, but the reviewer did such a great job. And, you know, it was an education to read that review of the paper. And that person had mentioned undiagnosing and as something that we should think about. And more recently, I had some interest in it again because the clinic that I work at, there are lots of patients who, you know, who have a lot of emotional ups and downs. And when they get very stressed, they have transient symptoms that amount to psychosis. And invariably, all these patients get diagnosed as schizoaffective disorder and they get loaded up with antipsychotics. So I was just wondering that, there has to be a process of removing this diagnosis on their health record. So, you know, they don't get labeled as schizoaffective right away, and they don't, you know, get dumped with all these antipsychotics. So I looked it up again, and I was happy to note that undiagnosing seems to have become a thing even in geriatric medicine and other branches of medicine, where they feel like to effectively taper off and stop medications and to prevent those the restarting of those medications, these diagnoses should be removed from the health record.
Could you tell me, I mean, what I'm just wondering, what does that say about the nature of diagnosis in the first place?
Like, it was a very important teaching moment for me when my department chair, who had researched schizophrenia for maybe 30 years at that point, if not longer, he walked into the room where all the residents sat and wrote their notes. He just looked at us and said that, you know, some people hear voices. Some people do have negative symptoms. Some people do appear quite disorganized. I think schizophrenia might exist. And this is someone who's, you know, spent his lifetime doing this work. So I think that was a very important teaching moment, that these are all constructs. And I think that, you know, and they're tools for helping people improve their lives. And when the tool does not feel relevant anymore, I think we should abandon it and move on to another tool. Otherwise, it becomes a burden. You know, for instance, I have a young patient in his 30s who hears voices almost constantly. And he deals with it. You know, he lives his life. He has a full-time job. He likes the work that he does. He has children. Lives a full life by all conventional standards. The voices really, really bothered him. By the textbook, he would meet a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and he could be loaded up on antipsychotics. But what purpose is that going to serve? Right? So for another person, that diagnosis and treatment from that point of view might serve a purpose. He's dealing with the voices, and he's happy living his life the way he's living it. So in his case, this tool of psychiatric diagnosis and psychiatric medications are just not useful.
This was wonderful, Swapnil. Thank you so much for doing this. This was great.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Madden America podcast. For more news, views, and updates, visit maddenamerica.com.